And though I'm no Olivier, because before Sugar Ray, you would say that the thing ain't the ring, it's the play. So give me a stage where it's Bull Hick and Rage, and though I can fight, I'd much rather recite. That's entertainment.
That's got to be one of the most memorable opening scenes in cinema. The monologue from boxing champion Jake LaMotta that opens Raging Bull, Oscar-winningly delivered by Robert De Niro. The 1980 classic from Martin Scorsese has become one of the best-loved films of American cinema, and you can watch it on a big screen again, because Raging Bull is getting a re-release. It came out of the relationship between Scorsese and De Niro that had already matured in films like Mean Streets and Taxi Driver, where Scorsese even gave himself a small part as a passenger in De Niro's taxi.
What are you doing? What are you doing at the meter? Did I tell you to do that at the meter? Put the meter back. Let the numbers go on. I don't care what I have to pay. I'm not getting out. Put the meter back on. Put it down.
Martin Scorsese as a rather neurotic passenger addressing a silent Robert De Niro in 1976's Taxi Driver. 4 years later, De Niro asked Scorsese to make a film about real-life boxing champion Jake LaMotta, with himself playing LaMotta. De Niro had read his autobiography and was desperate to bring this story to the screen. The film was plagued by troubles. Most people on the shoot thought that it wasn't going to work. Even the Hollywood studio, which was financing it, tried to get rid of it once filming was up and running, and nobody else wanted to touch it. The film opened to mild reviews in 1980, but at the Oscars the following year, Raging Bull got 8 nominations and won Best Film Editing for Thelma Schoonmaker and Best Actor for De Niro. The other brilliant performance, of course, comes from the then little-known actor by the name of Joe Pesci, as LaMotta's brother, Joey.
Hey, I'm your brother. You're supposed to believe me. Don't you trust me?
No, I don't.
Well, you don't. That's right.
I don't trust you when it comes to her. I don't trust nobody.
I gotta accept your answer, you know. I'm telling you now, if I hear anything, I swear on our mother I'm gonna kill somebody.
Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci in one of their many tense moments in Raging Bull. The BBC's Francine Stock asked Martin Scorsese if, following his badly received movie musical New York, New York in 1977, he took the film on to re-engage with the process of filmmaking.
Well, I think that's a good way of putting it. I guess that's what I was looking for, although I couldn't really say that at the time. But I think I was looking for something, again, that I could feel strongly about and I'd have passion for. I mean, in a way, a Taxi Driver had that Paul Schrader script.
Are you talking to me? Talking to me? Well, who the hell else are you talking to? Talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here.
I had that feeling for Mean Streets, of course, and to a certain extent New York, New York, there's no doubt, but I didn't feel like I had succeeded what I wanted to do in that film. The Last Waltz kept me creatively excited, and during the period of 76 to 78, I was really, during those 2 years, I was searching for something that would have an impact on me, that would make me pull together and actually physically shoot a film again, go on the set and deal with all the problems and deal with how to make a movie. And when one deals with that, one doesn't think of them except in practical terms. But I knew that, the middle of September of 78 or October, when I just finally realized this might be the right thing to do.
I just said don't overcook it. You're overcooking. Bring it over.
What's the thing?
Bring it over. It's like a piece of charcoal. Bring it over here.
You want your steak?
Yeah, right now.
Here, steak. Can't wait for this done.
No, I can't wait.
Good.
And the decision to film in black and white, and I know Michael Powell was instrumental in this, in that he observed how, with some early footage, how very, very vivid the boxing gloves were. But I wonder what you think black and white gives the picture.
It made it special in the sense that there were, I always pointed this out, there were about 4 or 5 other boxing films or films of boxing themes that were to be released that same year. One of them was Rocky II, I think. Another was The Main Event with Barbra Streisand and Ryan O'Neal. Another one was Matilda the Boxing Kangaroo. But they were all in color. I said, this would make it separate, this would make it special. But in so doing, we also, there's a residual effect, benefit that we got from the black and white, which was to frame it in the mind of the tabloids of the time. And my father only read the tabloids. He didn't read the New York Times. And so pictures from those newspapers was something I grew up with. This also picks up some residue from film noir coming out of late 40s, early 50s. It just does in the black and white, particularly with people dressed in that way. To all of that, I was able to be more expressive with the way we photographed the boxing scenes, the amount of graphic detail in it, including bloodletting.
Because you couldn't have done that in color. It just would have been too much.
In color, it might have been too much, although if you've seen some fights up front, it may not be exaggerating too much.
Well, certainly that was one of the most damaging evidences of punching that you have seen in recent years.
And it is a film of double acts. I mean, on screen, there's obviously Jake LaMotta and his brother, and then you have that combination of De Niro and Pesci working together, but also, obviously, you and De Niro working together because there was some writing going on as well as, obviously, De Niro having brought the idea to you in the first place. I mean, do you think in some ways that this film was your closest collaboration with him?
I think so. I think it really, starting with Mean Streets, going through Taxi Driver, New York, New York, I think we went through a long process. Ultimately, I think we sort of put everything we knew together, combined, into this picture, Raging Bull, which I thought would probably be my last picture in America, really, or that kind of film anyway.
Why? Why did you think that?
I didn't know if I was interested or could feel strongly about mounting a film again after that. In other words, you really have to feel strongly about the material, I think, or at least have something to prove. In other words, to prove a point about dealing with, how should I put it? Let's say you're going to make a film, you said, I'm going to make a film the spirit of a B film 1955 or 1961, as I did in Cape Fear, for example, but changed and reformulated for 1991 to reflect America around us at this point. But that was a kind of a challenge, and that was this very specific, almost technical chore. And there were other films in that respect that I did. Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, After Hours, even to a certain extent. But I didn't know if those were going to come anymore. Those, along with at least, if not films for me that were foremost in my body, in my mind, that I had to kind of make, like whether the good or bad, Last Temptation of Christ or Goodfellas and films like that. It was a little bit of a difficult time because if you can't draw on that reserve of caring about the work you do, then how could you work? Why make another movie? It's not worth it.
So when was the moment that you did feel that you would carry on then?
That was a year or two later, I think, after The King of Comedy, when Paul Schrader had finished writing Last Temptation of Christ, and I started checking out locations in January of 83, that was.
Good news is, yeah, I get the shot at the title. And the bad news is they want you to do the old flip-flop for them.
So what else?
What you expect? You know that was coming?
And the very visceral sense of horror that one gets watching those scenes, of course, enormously built up by the use of sound and your sound editor, Frank Warner. This extraordinary mix of noises that he used. I mean, explain for us a little bit about that.
Thelma Schoonmaker and I, really hadn't planned too much on the sound effects while we were editing the film. We were doing the sound effects as we went along. And Frank Warner was the man who really designed that. Actually, he became very possessive about those sound effects. He wouldn't tell us what many of them were. There were a few that in the second Sugar Ray fight, I think, which was done all with long lenses, there's some elephant cries and roars of lions and those sorts of things. But the actual punches, he told us a couple of ways he got them, but he would also, I believe, take his sound effects home with him or after film destroy them so that nobody else used them. This is maybe partially apocryphal, but I know that he was very private about it.
Was it sometimes surprising to you the effect that that would have added on top of the edit?
Very much so. It was very surprising when Frank put this stuff together with us, and I'd ask him certain things, and he'd come up with stuff, he'd come in. Finally, there was one point in which he said, I said, well, what haven't we used right now? And he said, silence. We pull all the sound out. Then the sound comes back in with a final blow.
He's on scene with big shots. How he can survive them, nobody knows.
Martin Scorsese on Raging Bull, getting a re-release in the UK. And the Oscar-winning director is returning to his love of music for his next project, Shine a Light. It's a documentary of the Rolling Stones in concert in a small New York theatre. That's due out in September.